Hey, everybody, Kevin Rose here. Welcome back to another episode of The Kevin Rose Show. In hosting this podcast, I feel very fortunate that I've had some pretty awesome guests on the show, some pretty inspiring guests. These would be some of the brilliant leaders and thinkers. People that come to mind would be, of course, Elon Musk, Jack Dorsey from Twitter and Square, Michael Pollan. I could name a whole slew of folks that were definitely fantastic people to have on the show and interview. Today's guest is right up there, Andy Ratcliffe. He's brilliant in a way that at times, as someone that's doing the interview, it just kind of stuns you. Like it just, some of the things that came out of his mouth, they just fly in the face of what I know to be true. And when that happens, it's a little frustrating because you're doing the interview and you have to pause to almost just soak it all in and then come up with the next question in a very good way. I thought this interview had me wanting more knowledge from Andy, so much so that I even asked him to write a book. I don't think he has the time to do that, but it was a really fun interview. For those of you that don't know Andy Ratcliffe, Andy is the co-founder of Benchmark Capital, which is one of the most respected and successful venture firms of all time. Just fantastic, phenomenal results over the years. And today, Andy is the co-founder and CEO of Wealthfront, which is a next-generation automated investment service with about $20 billion in assets under management. Now, in full disclosure, I'm an angel investor in Wealthfront, but that's not why I had Andy on. Andy is an absolute legend. So regardless of my investment, it was just great to have him on the show and to soak up all that knowledge. Now, in this episode, we talk about entrepreneurship. And like I mentioned, much of what he has to say today, it goes against every business book I've ever read in a very good way. And of course, we talk about investing, automated versus stock picking. We talk about Bitcoin and gold, Robinhood, the stock trading app, Square Cash, and a whole lot more. Oh, and one last thing I just want to remind you, make sure to sign up for my newsletter. I have a once a month, or actually I would say once every 4 to 6 weeks, newsletter that I put out that is just packed full of all the things that I'm reading. It can be books, podcasts, products that I'm checking out. You can sign up for that at kevinrose.com. I promise not to spam you, and it's very infrequent. So when you get it, definitely give it a click, and I'm sure you'll find something good in there. All right, with that, this is Andy Ratcliffe. Well, Andy, it's great to have you on the show. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me.
So many things to talk about. I mean, you are a legend in the tech space. First and foremost, having been one of the founders of Benchmark, which for people that don't know venture capital, I'm sure most of the people listening to this podcast probably heard of Benchmark, but if you haven't, I mean, definitely one of the absolute top 1% of all funds of all time. It seems like there isn't a company on the consumer side that you've missed. I mean, eBay, Dropbox, Twitter, Uber, Snapchat, Instagram. I mean, I could just go on and on of the great companies and founders that you've invested in. I would love to hear about that founding story. I mean, you started the firm, what, 1995?
Correct.
Where were you in your career? What were you doing? And why did you decide to start a venture capital firm?
Well, I had been in the venture business for about 10 years, 12 years, actually. And the firm that I was a partner at, Merrill Pickard Anderson and Iyer, which was one of the top five firms at the time, had gone through generational transition. Two of the founding partners were retiring. That left three of us, and we could either have taken that franchise forward or become free agents. And two of the three of us ended up teaming up with a partner from TVI, another one of the premier firms that was going through the same thing. That was Bob Cagle, and an entrepreneur from the Merrill Pickard portfolio and a friend of Bob Cagle's from TVI, and we got together and started Benchmark. So it was generational transition at two venture firms that really instigated it.
And in 1995, I'm thinking back to what I was doing. You know, I was obviously playing with Windows 95. What type of investments were happening in 95? This is pre 1.0. So was it a lot of chip investing at that time? Was there anything on the consumer side?
Well, actually, one of the things that we talked about in our roadshow to raise money for our first fund was a belief that consumer and technology were coming together and that that would create some tremendous opportunities. TVI had been fortunate to be an investor in Intuit. And that was probably the first example of a company that merged traditional consumer marketing with technology. And so Bob Cagle, coming from TVI, felt like that was going to be a really big opportunity. We even thought we would invest in pure consumer companies just to get some familiarity with consumer marketing to prepare us for the intersection of consumer and tech. But pure consumer companies tend not to have as good returns because there isn't the intellectual property that you can leverage. So we quickly did away with that and really focused on consumer tech. And we've made a lot of great enterprise investments over the years as well.
Back in 95, I mean, AOL was, I think, probably the biggest player in the online space at that point.
Yeah, I had invested in AOL at Merrill Pickard.
Oh, you did? Wow, yeah. Crazy. You saw this coming. I mean, it was clear to you that the penetration of desktops in the home was going to be a real thing. I mean, it was already well on its way at that point. What did you think of the web back then?
Well, it was, you know, it's better to be lucky than good. And the internet, the commercial internet, really took off beginning in 1995 with Netscape. Mm-hmm. And then Yahoo followed quickly thereafter. So the internet just started to take off when we started our fund, and we got to take advantage of that. And that's why I say it's better to be lucky than good, that there were some tremendous opportunities that allowed us to build our reputation.
How big was the fund back in those days?
Our first fund was only $85 million. As a matter of fact, it was the smallest fund in terms of dollars per partner. There were five of us, of any of the top firms. And our argument to the limited partners was we purposely capped the amount of money that we were going to manage in order to multiply the money more. So in return, we wanted a higher percentage of the profits. And that was very, very controversial at the time. And the people who bet on us were handsomely rewarded because our first fund, I think, was a 65x fund.
Wow.
So for every dollar you invested in the fund, you got out $65.
That is phenomenal. And where businesses, obviously, at this point in time, were a lot more capital intensive. Like they required, just had larger capital requirements to get off the ground. Would you say that was true?
Yeah, but you know, I think this is a misperception that people have. Every industry, when it gets started, has very modest capital requirements. You know, you used to be able to start a computer company for $1 million. You could start a disk drive company for less than $1 million. It's as the industry or market matures that you need more and more capital to gain an advantage. So I think this whole point about internet companies require less money than other companies is not true at all. Lotus got started on a couple of $100,000. Microsoft got started on even less.
So what are some of the themes when you think about the entrepreneurs that you've backed over the years, some of the greats and even the ones that you've interacted with that maybe you haven't backed, what are the common traits that you would say, are there any that reoccur that you just keep seeing over and over again?
Well, I would say the most important one is that they were able to observe an inflection point in technology that allowed them to build a new kind of product before others saw that. And then the challenge became who wanted it. So that's the exact opposite of what most every book on entrepreneurship talks about as the way companies get started, which is to look at a market, try to find a problem, and develop a solution. That leads to really mundane outcomes. If you want to build a really big company, you have to do the opposite. You have to start with an inflection point in technology because without change, there's seldom opportunity. Take advantage of that inflection point to build a product and then find a market that wants the product. So start with the product, look for the market versus the other way around. It's higher risk and higher return.
And what do you think about the last few years? I mean, certainly a lot of emphasis on artificial intelligence. And do you believe that is going to be our next big, you know, decade long pursuit? Is more new interesting startups in that arena? Or what are you looking at these days?
You know, well, first of all, I'm no longer a venture capitalist. I haven't been one for 15 years, so I don't think about that. But contrary to the way some venture capitalists represent it, venture capitalists are not visionaries. Quite the opposite. They're opportunists. We don't try to predict what's going to happen. Our job is to recognize a great vision when we see it. It's the entrepreneurs who are the visionaries. So I never try to predict.
What intrigues you? What has excited you in the past? Like, is it just that you are the first to kind of recognize that what the entrepreneur has figured out and that excites you? Like, what does your gut tell you? How do you decide to do an investment?
So not only must it have the opportunity to be big, but you have to have an unfair advantage. Otherwise, why are you going to be the winner versus someone else?
Mm-hmm. And how do you coach someone? And whether it be an existing employee that's reporting to you or, you know, an entrepreneur that is doing this for the first time. I mean, they're bound to make mistakes. Are you a believer in CEO coaching? Like, how do you take people from someone that just might be a great technologist and apply some type of structure to get them to be able to manage people?
Well, I think they need to want to be a leader to be a CEO. One of my concerns with young CEOs today is they want to focus on product, but they don't actually want to lead people. Mm-hmm. But they still want to be CEO. You can't be a CEO unless you want to lead. And that's why I'm glad I'm not a venture capitalist anymore, because I wouldn't do very well with the new generation of CEOs.
Do you have any recommendations for those folks that are like, that they're willing to admit, like they don't have a playbook for this? Like, how would you instruct someone that has a fantastic idea, that has a great vision, but just doesn't know how to naturally be a leader?
Let somebody else do it.
That's
how radical an idea.
Just stay head of product and bring in a CEO?
Yeah, or be the chairman and be heavily involved with the product and find someone with whom you can work, someone in whom you have trust, where they can lead the company and you can lead the product. But there's no such thing as CEO of product.
Right. In you know, moving into what you're doing today, and obviously as one of the founders of Wealthfront, how do you see yourself still growing as an entrepreneur?
Well, I think that companies need to be built to learn and individuals. Successful individuals, I find, are incredibly intellectually curious and built to learn. You know, the person who impresses me the most on this dimension is Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, he is a sponge like no one I have ever seen. That he constantly tries to get better and learn about more and more functions. And the people I know who've worked with him are just astounded by the rate at which he improves. Mm-hmm. Some people think they know it all already, and they tend not to improve at a rapid rate, and they tend not to do as well. Mm-hmm. So the one piece of advice that I give people, actually, for the last 15 years, I've been teaching on technology entrepreneurship courses at Stanford Graduate School of Business. And my parting advice to my students in every class is, if there's one thing that you can do, is keep on learning.
And how do you recommend they do that? I mean, is that through trial and error? Is it through books? Is it through surrounding yourself with high quality people?
Well, it's surrounding yourself with high quality people and searching out high quality people. You know, I am very much anti-blog, because people tend to revise history and write blog posts that make themselves look good. Or they have never had any success in their life, but they're really good writers, and people mistake that for knowing what they're talking about. So I try to seek out people who are experts in private conversation to learn from them.
That's great advice. How do you hire folks? Let's say for Wealthfront, when you're looking to hire someone, what are the traits that you're looking for, and what does that interview process look like?
Well, I prioritize passion over talent if they have enough talent. The person who is passionate about the opportunity is likely to invest more time learning. Mm-hmm. And so they are likely to grow at a much faster pace. They might be less capable than someone else, but if they're more passionate, they typically will pass that person.
And how do you unpack that passion? Like when you're doing the interview process, is there certain questions that you ask that you feel can kind of get to the core of that?
Well, I've been doing this for so long that I can tell actually more by the questions that the candidate asks me. Hmm. If you can tell when someone cares because they've prepared.
Right.
And they come full of questions, and not just questions, but penetrating questions. Mm-hmm. The person who is just interviewing, A, can't tell you what they're looking for. I mean, I love it when I meet someone who interviews with us in Facebook. That person clearly has no idea what they're doing.
Right.
Because how could you possibly interview at the two companies? They're right. Radically different. It means you don't really know what you want to do with your career. So I want someone who really knows what they want and is just crazy about succeeding and getting better. And yes. They have a lot of upside. So I'll take chances on people who are really raw if they're passionate and they have enough talent.
And what's your mentoring process like? Let's say someone is really passionate, they have enough talent, but they're not exactly where you need them to be in some particular skill set, or how do you get them? Well, I mean, I guess they would take it upon themselves at that point to try and hopefully improve that area, but how do you help guide them?
Actually, I don't think that you should improve your weaknesses. I think you hire to your weaknesses. I think you should double down on your strengths. That's, if you look at really successful people, they didn't become successful by being good at everything. Mm-hmm. They became successful because they were superb at something.
Right.
And then they were able to work with people who were good at the other things.
Interesting. So let's say you have an individual though that is like your head of marketing, and they've got, you know, 80% of what they need, but there's a few blind spots there. And you say hire to those weaknesses. Does that mean you try and fill an additional role to make up for their lack of capacity, or am I understanding that wrong?
Well, the VP of marketing is not an individual contributor. So they don't have to do each of the functions themselves. If mm-hmm. they're not good at email operations, they can always hire someone to do that. Or if they're not good at branding, they can hire someone who's really good at that. Mm-hmm. If they're not good at paid marketing, you know, advertising, they can hire someone who's good at that. They don't have to be great at everything. Very few people are.
No, that is totally understandable. I'm curious, like, how it sounds very, in some sense, this sounds amazing in that it's flying in the face of every single business book that you ever read out there.
I know.
Which is fantastic and really exciting because I love everything you're saying. But at the same time, it's like, it almost sounds too lax in that how do you do even a performance review with someone? Like, let's say there are these things that are lacking. Like, how would you give them that feedback?
Well, Kevin, you've worked in technology for a long time. Mm-hmm. You know that growth hacking or the growth function is really just an example of what I'm talking about with regard to hiring. You don't try to improve the things that you're not good at. You double down on what's working.
Right.
So you don't do experiments around the thing that isn't working in your product. You figure out what's working really well and you try to figure out how to make that even better. I'm just talking about applying that methodology to people.
Huh. Yeah, it's so radical. I'd love to see it in practice. It sounds fascinating.
I've seen it in practice my entire career.
It just hasn't been labeled that, you mean? Like it hasn't been called out as such?
But that's what great executives do. And they piece together a team who complement one another. Mm-hmm. Or they at least attempt to.
You sound like what your approach is a lot more holistic in a sense. It's looking at the whole organization as like this living, breathing organism that you may have certain strengths you want to like accelerate and add fuel to the fire on, and you have certain weaknesses that you want to kind of build up and hire for. How does this compare to, say, the hiring practices of like a Google, where I feel like they're just looking for pedigree?
Well, they used to. I think they learned from the data that it doesn't actually work.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I, at one point in my career, did that as well. And what I learned is that's not a very good way to hire people. Just because you have a great pedigree doesn't mean you're not going to succeed, but it doesn't mean that you will either.
Right.
You really need to look at the passion, the rate at which someone learns, and their judgment. So I also look for proxies for judgment.
Hmm. Can you go into that a little bit deeper? Like, give me some examples.
Sure. Look, the CEO is seldom the person who earned CEO versus the founder is seldom the smartest person in the room, but they're usually the one with the best judgment. What's mm-hmm. judgment? It's decision making under uncertainty. Anyone can make decisions if they have all the data. The most impactful decisions in a business are usually the ones that are made under uncertainty. So mm-hmm. I ask for situations in which there was a lot of uncertainty where they had to make a decision, and what were the outcomes. A great example of this and a great proxy is, what companies did you choose to work for?
Mm-hmm.
What I find is that people who work for a very successful company come to understand what are the keys to success, and they look for that in their next employer. Someone who's worked for two unsuccessful companies has no idea what to look for, and they generally, as a result, make a decision based on compensation, which only dooms them to fail again.
That makes sense. Well, I guess jumping into Wealthfront, is there an example? I'm curious to know, when you do make a decision on something and it ends up not being, you know, it's imperfect information. You make a decision, say product-wise, you roll something out, it doesn't work out. What do you do as the CEO? Are you someone that wants to get at the data and understand why? Are you quick to cut something in terms of like getting rid of the functionality? How do you work that from a product standpoint?
Well, I'm a really big devotee of Clay Christensen's, the Harvard Business School professor who really developed disruption theory. And he coined a term in The Innovator's Dilemma that I just love, which is fail fast and cheap. My great passion is product market fit. I'm the guy who coined the term. I've taught a course on it for 13 years at Stanford. It's something that I find is the absolute key to success of a business. And I constantly try to figure out how to do a better job of finding it. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's really clear to me is that if you don't find product market fit immediately, you don't change the product, you change the market. You iterate on the market, you don't iterate on the product. And so if you don't get traction immediately in a market, you fail fast and cheap and you try a different market. And if after trying two or three markets, basically different hypotheses, they don't work, then you cut bait.
How do you make that initial decision when you haven't even tested something in a new market? Let's say it's a giant leap forward, like, you know, comparing what we had as smartphones back in the Windows CE days to when the actual iPhone jumped out and just blew us all away. Like, how do you, when the market hasn't used it yet, how do you make the call to go after something, a new idea that is so novel and so different?
Well, we've tried to codify that. I'm a big believer in the lean startup methodology, where you develop a value hypothesis and test the value hypothesis. And only once you've proven your value hypothesis do you test a growth hypothesis. So the value hypothesis is the what, the who, and the how. What are you going to build? For whom is it relevant? And what's the business model? That's the how. One of the biggest mistakes that people make, and I think this is really promoted by Y Combinator, is that you first prove growth to get money. And I think this is horrible because it's like building a house on a shaky foundation.
Mm-hmm.
You can game growth.
Right.
So I think the only growth that matters in the beginning is organic growth, because mm-hmm. you can only get organic growth through word of mouth. You can only get word of mouth if you've truly delighted your customer and found product market fit. Mm-hmm. So in other words, product market fit is just a fancy way of saying you've proven your value proposition. And how do you know you've proven it? Well, in a consumer company, it's exponential organic growth. Mm-hmm. So if we don't achieve exponential organic growth right away, we iterate on the market. Mm-hmm. Building more features doesn't ever get you fit. That's the mistake that entrepreneurs continuously make.
Oh, I mean, it just gets you confusion, right? It just makes the product more bloated.
Yeah. Actually, removing features sometimes gets you the fit.
Right.
That's really counterintuitive.
Right.
The problem is not everyone, myself included, and our company included, comes up with insights that are compelling. We try. And how do we test it? So we try to beg, borrow, and steal from other companies to come up with ways to do a better job to validate hypotheses. We go through the customer development methodology. We use design sprints, which we find to be incredibly helpful to figuring out whether or not we've hit a nerve.
I'm a big fan of design sprints. I think it's a fantastic process. It's one that we used at Google quite a bit. Well, I'd love to jump in to talk about Wealthfront, because what a really cool novel idea when it first launched, the idea of automating and robo-investing in a world that at the time was largely, you know, just paid managers that were charging you too much and seemed to be just putting you into whatever they thought was, and sometimes what they were compensated for.
Yes, that was the unfortunate part.
Yeah, versus having a lot of it automated away in a much more efficient manner. Can you tell me kind of what Wealthfront does today?
Sure. We describe ourselves as a next generation banking service that helps young professionals manage their money. We do this with with high interest checking and low cost investment management services, all delivered through a 5-star rated app. The vision for the business is to automate all of your personal finances. So we've coined a term for this called self-driving money. And what we mean by that is you can now direct deposit your paycheck with us. We'll automatically pay your bills and then route the remaining money to the most appropriate savings vehicle, depending on your situation or goals. And so it basically takes a part of your life that most people don't enjoy, and we automate all of it. We do it for incredibly low cost, and we do it incredibly efficiently.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. I think on the investing side, can we just go into that a little bit on exactly what you do with those funds? Because, you know, I know that you have some really cool technology in terms of the tax loss harvesting that you do and some things behind the scenes that are different than a lot of other providers out there.
Well, it's really funny. People think what we do is fancier than what we actually do. What we've basically done is taken best practices that are used by the best financial advisors, and we implemented them in software to automate them. And by automating it, we can radically lower the minimum account size. So a traditional financial advisor requires an account minimum of $1 million. And we also lower the fee to 0.25%, whereas the average financial advisor charges 1%. So through automation, we're able to radically lower our costs, which we can pass along in form of lower minimum and lower fees. So what do we do? Well, we started with a diversified and rebalanced portfolio of low-cost index funds. That was really simplistic. By the way, 95% of the people who say they offer a robo-advisor, that's all they do. That's what we did when we started in December of 2011. And back then, I used to say, we add very little value and price accordingly. So since then, we've added quite a bit of capability. Again, no proprietary algorithms, just automating best practices. So one of the things that very wealthy clients of high-end financial advisors had available to them was something called tax loss harvesting. At the end of the year, the advisor would look at the portfolio, and if there were losses, they would sell those securities to recognize the loss to lower their taxes. And they'd replace the securities that were sold with similar securities, but not identical, to maintain the risk and the return of the portfolio. And 31 days later, they would replace security with the original security. And so we've been doing that at the index fund level or the ETF level since the end of 2012. And the average pre-tax benefit of that is about 5% of your portfolio value per year. So if your tax rate is 40%, that means we save you on the order of 2% of your portfolio value per year. So that's eight times what we charge as a fee. So it's almost ridiculous to try to do this yourself, because we look for these opportunities to harvest losses every day. It's too hard for an individual or a traditional financial advisor to do that, because if you think about a couple hundred clients and all of the different tax lots that they have to look at, they just couldn't do it every day in a spreadsheet.
Right.
A computer doesn't care if we have, you know, 200 clients or 200 million clients. It's no more work for a computer to do. And so you can harvest a lot more when you look for these opportunities every day versus just at year end, because the market might have gone down mid-year and gone back up at the end of the year, so you don't have any losses. But right. In our case, we would harvest those losses.
How do you determine, or how does the algorithm determine when the right time to harvest is? I was always confused by that, because especially in like what markets we live in today, it's like, how do you know if a 4% drop is even significant to harvest a loss, say?
You know, we've gone back and looked at the data, and it's generally approximately a one standard deviation loss.
Okay.
So we've back tested this many times, and that's generally the case. So we first did it at the ETF level, and then we did it at the within the index. So we recruited Bert Malkiel, an emeritus professor at Princeton, who actually invented the index fund. When he wrote A Random Walk Down Wall Street, probably the most influential book in investing ever. And he said, you know, you're missing an opportunity here. You're harvesting among index funds. Why not harvest within an index fund? And by that, he meant there are 500 stocks that comprise the S&P 500. Mm-hmm. Well, in any given day, the S&P 500 might be up 1%. But a number of the 500 companies within the index might have traded down a lot. Coke right. might have announced bad earnings. So right. if Coke traded down,
Pepsi.
So you buy some Pepsi. And then 31 days later, you trade back into Coke. And that adds another 0.2% after tax, approximately, for most people every year. There's obvious variance in that number. But again, that pays for our fee again, one times over. Mm-hmm. So we did that. And then we added something called smart beta, which people like DFA charge 0.5% a year to manage. We do it for free because our marginal cost is so low. And then we added something else called risk parity, which had a $100 million minimum at Bridgewater. We do it at a $100,000 minimum and at a very low fee. So just automating these best practices that have been proven through academic research to work, we're able to deliver something that on a net of fee, after tax, risk-adjusted basis, you can't touch. Even the world's best financial human financial advisor can't outperform because of their fees. Mm-hmm. So that's what we do on the investment side. And by the way, we automate the movement of money into your account and out of your account. You can transfer securities to us. We won't sell them right away. We'll do that in a tax-optimized fashion to minimize the amount of taxes that you pay. So there's all these things that we do that people who call themselves robo-advisors don't come close to doing.
Yeah, it seems like there's been a mad rush by the traditional players out there to quickly, you know, add the robo-advisor language somewhere on their website to say, look, we're hip, we're young, we do this too, you know, you should stay with us and not leave, because it seems that there's a lot of people have bailed on their traditional, you know, old school advisors to move to something like Wealthfront. I'm curious, you know, the obviously in subreddits and the deeper places of the internet, like these days, everyone trades stock trading tips. Everyone's gambling these days. Things like Robinhood app have become very popular, and especially enabling people like the average individual to actually leverage their dollars, which is just insanity, but you know, it is gambling. What are your thoughts on people doing individual stock picking?
It's a terrible idea, and the academic research is incredibly consistent on this point. You know, Burt made, 48 years ago, when he published A Random Walk Down Wall Street, he basically, for the first time, explained to the world that they would be far better off buying a diversified portfolio of index funds or even investing in an index rather than trying to pick individual securities. Mm-hmm. You know, less than 10% of professional investors outperform the market over 5 years. And those are people who are doing it for a living every single day. So what makes an individual investor who's doing it with their spare time think they can outperform the market? The problem is that every once in a while, we have really significant increases in the market over a short period of time. And whenever that happens, we see a day trading breakout.
Sure, because everyone believes they're a professional. It's working, you know?
Right, because this happens every 15 years ago. So the problem is, like, since the market bottom in March or April, the market is up 50 or 60%. So if you're buying individual securities and you're up 30%, you think you're a genius, because on an absolute basis, you're doing unbelievably well. How often can you increase the size of your portfolio by 30% over 6 months? The problem is you're actually a moron. Because if the market's up 50 or 60%, if you had invested in an index fund, you'd be up 50 or 60%, not 30. But mm-hmm. And so this is the problem with absolute versus relative returns. It's relative returns that matter, but most people who are amateurs only think about absolute returns, which is why they think they're doing really well if they're up 30%. The problem is when the market turns, and the market is seldom up 60% over 6 months, they will do really poorly if the market is down 5% or even flat. Because if they underperform that by 20%, boy, then they're really in trouble. Mm-hmm. So it's not surprising to me that this is happening. You know, it happened around the internet bubble in the late 1990s. It happened in the 82-83 time period. It always happens when we see a big increase in the market size. And it's fun. Heck, professional sports went away and you couldn't bet on sports, I think that investing in individual stocks became a replacement.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. Do you feel like you need to serve that market, though, in the sense that, like, I'll give you a great example. Maybe I'm just a rare, small little market for you, but I have a Wealthfront account. I think of it as my kind of conservative, you know, risk score 3, like just like set it and forget it, not don't worry about it. And then there's individual positions of companies that I really believe in, you know, like just like up and coming, like the Pelotons of the world or the Giants.
But that's not day trading. That's not day trading.
That's correct. That's correct.
So you're buy and hold.
I am buy and hold. I'm buy and hold. Like, you know, I've been holding Amazon stock for 10 years or longer. You know, it's just like that. I feel, do you feel there's a place for that inside of Wealthfront? Like, would I eventually be able to have my holdings there?
Well, perhaps. It's not something we're focused on right now. Right now, we just want to make sure that a delegated managed solution works really well for you. If you want to consolidate everything with us, that's certainly something that we could consider. Instead, what we've focused our development efforts on is adding the capabilities to deliver on that self-driving money vision, mm-hmm. which is why a few months ago, we rolled out a full suite of checking features. So you can direct deposit with us, you can pay your bills and pay your friends with us electronically. We give you a debit card to do spending or withdrawals from our 19,000 free ATMs. You can deposit your checks via our mobile app, and very shortly you'll be able to send checks. So we give you a full suite with no fees, and it's a delightful user interface, the likes of which you would never find in your bank. And then a couple of weeks ago, we rolled out Autopilot, the first capability in our self-driving money suite. And Autopilot monitors an account. Now, it can be your regular checking account, or it can be your Wealthfront Cash account that has all of these checking features. And whenever the balance goes above a threshold that you set by more than $100, we will automatically sweep that money to your preferred investment account. And we'll give you complete control, and that we send you an email to let you know we're going to do it so you could cancel it whenever you want. But by doing this, we completely automate your life. Now, the money is going to move a lot faster if you keep everything at Wealthfront, meaning you can do your banking and your investing at Wealthfront. But if you prefer to do your banking elsewhere, you can do that as well. We'll automate your finances that way. So we automate your savings in a way that just takes all of that burden off of you. By the way, no one automates savings like that.
I've never heard of that before. This is the first I've ever even seen anything like that. Yeah, it's insane.
Because the checking features are all commodities. Everybody offers the same thing.
Right. Well, the thing that first attracted me to the Wealthfront kind of checking account, I guess it was just the cash account back then, was just that how insane the interest rates were, and just no other bank is even giving you anything, let alone. So that was nice to see.
Well, our philosophy, so our mission is build a financial system that favors people, not institutions. So if we build all of this automation that lowers costs, we want to share that with our clients. We don't want to keep all of that for ourselves. We want to make money with our clients, not from our clients. And so all we did is we were willing to take a much lower spread because it costs us a lot less money to operate the account, so that we could give you a much higher interest rate. We pay the highest interest rate that you would find on any checking account equivalent.
Yeah, it's great. How do you handle person-to-person transfers? I mean, there's obviously a big push from people like Venmo, which is, I guess, PayPal and Square, to support the unbanked and really make cash transfers as inexpensive and fast as possible. Is that a big push for you as well? I haven't seen that feature in the app. Maybe I just haven't looked for it.
And you won't. We think you should use Venmo or Square app or something else to do that. They're really good at that. Why would we try to recreate something that they're really good at? The nice thing is they work really well with us.
Right, because you're just another source of funds at that point.
Exactly.
Yeah, I love that you're saying that, because I was worried that you were going to go into that space.
No, what we want to do is we want to focus our development efforts on things that add value, that make your life easier on top of your existing financial life.
One of the things that I would love to see is the ability to kind of dial up. Right now, when you choose the funds that you're going to invest in on my behalf, it's all based on a 1 to 10 risk score. And that's something I can either take a quiz for, and it says, yeah, I think you're an 8, or I think you're a 9, you're even more risky. Will there ever be individual knobs to say, you know, I would like a little bit more of this gold ETF, or I want to dial down my international exposure a bit? Like, do you think that's, or should that just be completely automated forever?
Well, it all depends on if you prefer control over performance. because our PhDs have done the work to figure out what's the best mixture of asset classes for any particular risk tolerance. Academics would tell you the only thing that matters in the composition of your portfolio is your tolerance for risk. Now, most people don't know how to determine that, and that's why we built some algorithms to figure that out and to balance out for the fact that people usually overstate their tolerance for risk. So we don't ask you what is your tolerance for risk. We ask you some questions to get to try to figure out what it truly is and where the inconsistencies are. So by definition, if you don't choose one of our asset allocations, you're likely to have a worse risk-adjusted return. So if you're telling me that you want, you'd rather have control than performance, that's something that we historically have not paid attention to.
As odd as that sounds, I think there are a lot of people out there that like to say, you know what, I do want a little bit more exposure to, say, technology, for example, or I would like to have 5% of my assets be in Bitcoin.
You know, I completely hear you. And historically, I think maybe we've been too paternalistic because we want to try to keep you from making that mistake.
Right.
Because timing the market, the research is really clear that individuals buy when the market goes up and sell when the market goes down. So what they're most likely to do is buy technology when technology goes up.
Right.
Or buy Bitcoin when Bitcoin is up. That's the worst time to do it. And actually, there's a company called Dalbar that has been researching this for decades. And they find that this costs you on the order of 1.5% to 3.5% per year on your portfolio return.
I have a standing order with Wealthfront to essentially take, I haven't done the autopilot yet or the self-driving money piece of it yet, but it's basically take a percentage of what would be my savings every single Friday. And it just does that like clockwork. So I'm just like constantly dollar cost averaging my way into the market. So that's kind of the way you'd recommend doing it.
That's what the data would show is a better way to do it. Or taking autopilot where it's a little bit more intelligent about your balance. Because some people want to make sure that they keep a particular balance for their day-to-day transactions.
Right. And then what are your thoughts on cryptocurrency? I mean, being a technologist, you must look at that and think it has some value, or are you not a fan?
Well, I think it has tremendous value as a way to reduce friction on transactions. If you know, MasterCard and Visa charge a really big tax on all transactions that has to be passed along in terms of the price that you pay. You know, they're earning something like 2.6 to 2.9% on every transaction. Well, you as the consumer have to pay for that. Mm-hmm. So going to cryptocurrencies can eliminate that tax. So I think there's tremendous value there.
So do you see blockchain as a framework then, like a framework for transit versus say like a store of value, like a gold, like a gold-like asset or something like that?
Well, as an investor, what I pay attention to is the fact that in order for something to be an investment, it has to have a cash flow because that's tangible. Only if an asset has a cash flow can it be accurately or somewhat accurately valued. If it doesn't have a cash flow, it's a speculation. Why is gold worth what it's worth? It's purely emotional.
Right.
Purely emotional. So gold is a speculation. Okay. I don't know any sophisticated investors that own speculations. No university endowment, which are the best managed pools of capital in the world, own gold. Mm-hmm. They consider that ridiculous. So Bitcoin as an investment is a speculation. It's not an investment. Therefore, I don't think it should be kept in a portfolio. Now, if you want to do it for fun, like going to the horse track, then by all means. But it's a gamble. It's not an investment.
Yes, it's certainly a gamble. There's no arguing that.
There's no way to evaluate what it should be worth.
Yeah. I mean, the only way you could evaluate or put some type of proxy against it would be like active participants in the network and actual real world usage of the network itself. You could, then you could say the underlying network has value.
I understand that, but how do you translate that into what you pay for unit? I mean, how could you value a dollar or a euro that
it's just
way?
Scarcity. Yeah, but at the same time, you're not really, I mean, the dollar is so unpegged from reality right now. How do you even value the dollar?
You don't. But again, you shouldn't be buying currencies as an investment. They're speculations.
Yeah, that's a great point. What do you do? I'm curious, Andy, like when you're looking at the market and you're like, okay, I mean, we're in some weird times right now. It just feels like the market has just been propped up time and time again. How do you, as someone that wants to get a little defensive, do you just have them dial back their risk setting?
You shouldn't be offensive. You shouldn't be defensive. You cannot time the market. So Bert Malkiel likes to say, you cannot time the market. So don't even try. Just focus on the three things over which you do have control, which are diversification, minimizing fees, and minimizing taxes. Mm-hmm. And not surprisingly, that's what we deliver with our investment service.
And then when you set your risk or your tolerance for risk at that point, you're saying, okay, forget the market, what it's doing, what it has done, what it's going to do. It's more about, when am I going to be retiring? Is that how you would, what factors do you look at there?
Well, we look at your capacity to take risk and your willingness to take risk. So we refer to them as your objective and subjective tolerance for risk, respectively. So what is your capacity to take risk? If you have enough, if you're earning money at a rate that is growing at a particular rate, and you're spending at a particular rate, then you either can afford your lifestyle or you cannot, and in perpetuity. So if you're likely to have more money in retirement than you need, then you have more capacity to take risk. If you don't have enough money to fund your retirement, if you project all of this out, then you don't have any capacity to take risk, and therefore you shouldn't. Now, some people, you know, go to Vegas if they don't have any money because they figure, hey, right, I don't have anything. I might as well bet it all to see if I'm going to get something. But that's not very responsible. So that's your capacity to take risk. Your willingness to take risk is based on your subjective reaction to particular stimuli. So if the market's down 10%, so we ask you questions like, if the market trades down 10%, do you invest more? Do you sell? Or do you just stay put?
Right.
So
yeah, I always say buy more to that one.
Yeah, but the problem is almost no one who says buy more buys more. We actually have the data. That's the problem. So we ask you a bunch of different questions, and then we look for the consistency of the answers. Because if you say that you'll buy more, but and then another emotional question like that, you're less tolerant, then you are less tolerant overall. So the more consistent you are, the more likely you are to take risk. The less consistent you are, the more we should go to the lowest common denominator, which is your least risk tolerant
right
capability.
But you don't ask it on the flip side. You don't say if the market's up 50%, what
yes,
do you
we
want
do
to do? Oh, sure, you do ask
do
that?
Absolutely.
You don't say 50% though. It's something no much smaller.
Yeah.
Cause I'm looking at, this is my problem, Andy. I'm looking at the markets. I'm like, okay, we're up 50%. And I hear you. I totally understand.
I know it does. But you got to remember, Kevin, nothing about good investment feels right.
Yeah.
So it makes no sense that, I mean, it does not feel right to invest when the market goes down and to sell when the market goes up. But you that's how you make money. So literally nothing about good investing practices feels right. And that's why almost everyone is terrible at it. And when software takes emotion out of it.
I wonder what it says about my psychology in that I have no problem. I actually am one of the people when the market is down 10, 15, 20%, I really do buy more because I just know it's going to recover. And I have confidence in that. The flip side is my issue. When the market's up 50%, then I'm just like sitting there being like, oh, it's going to crash any day now, you know? And well, I have a hard time wanting to invest more.
Well, it all depends if you're trying to make money in the short term or the long term. That's why we tell people that if you need money in the next 3 years, you should not invest it in Wealthfront. You should put in our cash account on which you earn interest. But you should, if you're going to buy a house, if you're saving to buy a house in the short term, you should not take market risk. But if you're willing to invest it for more than 3 years, then over the long term, you're going to do just fine. The market's going to be volatile. It's going to go up and down. But over the long term, if you just keep on dollar cost averaging into the market, you're going to do exceptionally well. And actually, the more volatile it is, the higher your ultimate net worth is going to be. Again, that's counterintuitive.
Why is that? Is that because of the cost harvesting?
No, because you get to buy, because if you're investing a consistent amount, you're getting to buy a bunch on the dips, which is the equivalent of buying when the market is on sale.
Right.
And so, again, it's counterintuitive, but you end up with more money if you invest in a volatile market.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah.
It doesn't feel right at all, does it?
Well, and it's also crazy how many people don't know that if the market drops 20%, they just think it has to recover by 20% to get back to where it was. You know, it's like it's people don't often do the full math here and what's going on behind the scenes.
We write about all these things in our blog, and one of the things that we pointed out is, what do you think the average time to recovery is? From a market correction where the market trades down 10%.
What do I think the average time is?
Yeah. How long do you think it takes to recover that?
From 10%, I would say, well, historically, probably, I don't know, maybe a year and a half, year and a quarter?
4 months.
4 months.
Everyone always thinks that it takes longer. How about from a bear market where it's down 20%?
Down 20%? I wouldn't know. I would just be guessing.
It's a year and a half.
Year and a half.
And so if you leave your money invested, it's like you're going to make 20% over a year and a half. That's a hell of a return.
Right.
Rather than trying to time it and figure it out.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So this is why, I was a pretty good professional investor. I don't invest any of my own money. I just delegate it and do it this way.
Yeah.
And if you're building your career, spending time researching stocks on which you're going to lose on a relative basis to the index would be far better spent reading and learning about your particular profession to get mm-hmm. better at it.
Mm-hmm. So you mean focus on the increasing your earning power, basically?
Exactly.
Yeah. So tell me, I don't want to take up too much of your time. We're almost at an hour now. I'm curious, though, it seems like you're just getting started with the self-driving money. Where does this all go? Like, what does this look like 5 years from now? What's the full picture?
Well, we have a long way to go in terms of the number of sources and destinations for your money, the number of places that we can monitor, and the number of places we can send that money. You know, we can ultimately send it to pay down your student loan, and we can do that intelligently for you. So we only do it in particular interest rate environments and not in other interest rate environments. Another thing that we can add a tremendous amount of value in is money movement, speeding money movement. One of the things that we've learned over and over again is the faster we move money, the more people trust us, the more money they give us. So if we can make money movement immediate, then the odds are you're going to love that. So in the fourth quarter, you're going to see us offer the ability to transfer money from your checking account equivalent to your investment account the same day. Mm-hmm. You can't do that anywhere else. So if you're on the Wealthfront platform, everything is going to be immediate.
Now, is that investing in or coming out of?
Either way? It can't come out of because of settlement.
Right.
So when you sell a security, we're subject to that one restriction.
But you could float that if you know that the settlement is going to occur or it has taken place, like the sale has taken place, couldn't you float the settlement?
Absolutely. And so we can do really interesting things there too. So we basically want to get rid of float in the banking system. You know, with our, if you direct deposit at Wealthfront, you get your paycheck 2 days sooner. What I didn't realize until we started on this endeavor was that employers have to deposit your paycheck 2 days before you get it. And that's because the bank holds on to it to earn interest on that money. That's called float. So what we do is we give you the money as soon as the employer deposits it.
That's amazing. I had no idea.
I know. It's just banks make money in all of these insidious ways. And it's all based on, you know, 200 years ago or 150 years ago with the Pony Express, it took time to move all of this money. But when everything went electronic, the bank still kept it. And that's why our mission is to favor people over institutions, to do the things that you would expect someone to do for you. So taking float out of the system has tremendous opportunity to build financial nirvana.
Yeah. Some of the stuff you guys are doing is just so cool. Like two things I want to mention real quick before we go. I love that you're doing, it's like in my mind, it's almost functioning like a RAID array on the back end for your banks. Like you have multiple banks supporting your checking service, right? So if I have a cash account, there are multiple banks behind the scenes that are offering that FDIC insurance. You can actually offer a larger insurance than any other bank out there. Is that right?
We offer $1 million of FDIC insurance because we broker it out to a number of different, to four different FDIC insured banks.
So you're spreading out $250K across, like if you put $1 million in, you're doing $250K across four banks. Correct. It's brilliant.
It's all software. And look, you couldn't do these things manually. There's a lot of things that you can do if you automate them that lead to a better outcome.
It's so cool. The last thing I want to mention too, I actually had a buddy that was asking me about this and I told him I'd bring it up on the podcast. Your interest rates for, so he has a Wealthfront account, a bunch of dollars invested, and you offer these real-time like loans against those equities, right? Mm-hmm. And the rates are fantastic. I don't know what it was. It was 2-something%. How does that work exactly? So you're locking up the equities, taking out a loan, and then does that rate change over time?
You're describing what we call our portfolio line of credit, and we think it's the fastest, easiest, and cheapest way to borrow. So if you have an investment account with us of at least $25,000, you're automatically enrolled in the portfolio line of credit. There's no credit check. There's no work that you have to go through. At any time that you want to borrow up to 30% of your account value, you push one button and you get the money the next morning.
That's amazing.
So if you have $25,000, you push one button, you say, I want to borrow $8,000. It'll show up in your account the next morning. Now, the rates vary from 2.6 to 3.3%. And we give you a better rate the more money you have invested with us, not the more money you borrow. So if you go to a traditional brokerage or bank, they give you better rates for borrowing more money. We don't think that's a good incentive. We want to create an incentive for you to save more. But the lowest rate is 2.6%. And so there's no paperwork, literally no paperwork. People who use this service can't believe that it exists.
Yeah, it's crazy because I have friends that, you know, they're talking about, well, I don't even know that they should be doing this, but they could almost just refinance their car or pay off credit cards and just have a much better rate.
Absolutely.
What am I missing?
Nothing. And by the way, there's no minimum payment monthly. So the interest accrues and you can pay it all off at the end whenever you want to.
That's pretty awesome.
It's almost too good to be true.
I know. It feels like it. That's why I'm kind of searching for a question. I'm like, okay, there's some kind of something I'm missing here.
So the consistent theme is by implementing everything in software, we lower the cost and we share the savings with our client. What a novel idea.
Yeah.
But the problem is financial institutions don't share.
Yeah. Well, it's great. It's a fantastic product. And, you know, I'm honored to be an investor as well, you know, a few rounds ago in the early days. Well, Andy, thank you so much for being on the show. Obviously, one last question. Have you written a book about any of these like entrepreneurial kind of principles, or do you have your version of Ray Dalio's book out there?
No, I don't have the time. Between running the company and teaching at Stanford, I am flat out. So a lot of people have asked me to write about product market fit.
That's something that
I'd love to, but I just don't have the time.
It sounds like you're against blogging, so it's not going to happen there.
I blog about personal finance. So it's not about your career or advice about things like that. But we do blog about, and actually what we do in our blog is, again, very counterintuitive. We offer data-driven, actionable advice on personal finance. So if you read most personal finance blogs, they give you the traditional rules of thumb. But when you look at the data, the rules of thumb actually seldom work. So we explore a bunch of misperceptions about personal finances.
Does that come in a newsletter as well?
No, it's just if you go to blog.wealthfront.com, you find it that way.
Okay.
Or if you just search for the Wealthfront blog, we publish one or two posts every week.
I'd love to see that in a newsletter as well. That would be really cool. Is your Stanford course, is it online?
It isn't, because it's I teach using the case method. Lectures lend themselves much better to posting online. An interactive session on a case doesn't really translate very well to a posting.
Ah, you're killing me. All your good content is hidden.
Sorry.
You got to do something. We got to get a book out of you at some point. Well, Andy, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, that is it for this episode. One last friendly reminder, head on over to kevinrose.com. There you can get all the show notes when you click on my podcast, and also sign up for my newsletter, once a month newsletter. I'm sure you'll enjoy it. That's it for now. Be well.